Hi, this is Katie Day, and welcome to Creating Ripples, the programme that showcases inspirational women across the globe. Sometimes it can be the small acts and achievements that can create the biggest ripples. We're here to share some amazing stories. They may make you laugh, they may make you cry. They are guaranteed to always inspire you. Today, it is my absolute pleasure to be interviewing Lama Jilongma Zangmo. Lama Zangmo first became a practicing Buddhist in 1977. Having received teachings from many highly respected lamas, she was inspired to enter the four-year closed retreat in 1984, during which time she became ordained as a Buddhist nun. When the next long retreat started in 1989, Lama Zangmo wished to further her retreat experience, and she was also asked to help and advise the new retreatants. Having completed that retreat in 1993, Lama Zangmo then entered a third long retreat and became the resident retreat teacher to the other women retreatants. That retreat ended in 1997, bringing the total number of years Lama Zangmo spent in retreat to 11 and a half. Lama Zangmo was then asked to help run the Kagyu Zamye Dzong London, which was officially opened in 1998. Since then, the London Centre has flourished under Lama Zangmo's guidance and established itself as a much-needed Dharma Centre in the capital city, providing a full and varied programme of teachings and events throughout the year. In 1998, Lama Zangmo became fully ordained as a Jilongma at an historic ceremony in India. Lama Zangmo is inspired to work tirelessly and joyfully in service to the Dharma and helping others. In recognition of her long experience, selfless qualities and commitment, she became the first person in the UK to be honoured with the title of Lama at a heartwarming ceremony in London in June 2001. Thank you so much for giving up your time, because I know how incredibly busy your schedule is and how many demands you have in your time. I have so many questions, I'm not quite sure where to start.
Sure.
The first one is, I'm fascinated about your journey from Denmark to Buddhism.
Yes, yes.
How did that happen?
Well, yes. Somehow I didn't meet Buddhism in Denmark.
Ah.
I traveled quite a lot when I was younger.
Right.
I traveled to India, lived in different places in European countries, other European countries, and then I started reading books about Buddhism and spirituality sort of when I was quite young.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of searching, I suppose you can say, without really knowing what you're looking for. You're just reading certain things, and I came across books by Trungpa Rinpoche. I happened to walk into a bookstore in Amsterdam, and there was this pile of books had just come in of his newest book called Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. And I picked one up.
Wow.
And I just read a bit, and I thought, yes, this is something I can really relate to. This is something I can really understand. Because before that, when I had read about Eastern spirituality or philosophy, it had been cloaked in, lots of foreign terms and Sanskrit terms, or just I didn't understand it. I just felt like, well, maybe yes, maybe this is, but I don't really get to the heart of it. It doesn't speak to me directly. And with that book, it totally spoke to me so directly. And I had read Buddhist books before, but that was what made it very clear to me that I wanted to go to Samyaling in Scotland. I wanted to learn more. I wanted to sort of explore this whole idea of meditation, Buddhism, and Tibetan Buddhism. And Samyaling was one of the few places in the this was in the early 70s, I started reading, and then in 77 I went up to Samyaling. So there were still not many Tibetan Buddhist centers in the early 70s.
No.
And that was how I came to Scotland, and that was the beginning of my Buddhist, really of the true Buddhist journey. That I,
yeah,
that's when I became a Buddhist. I was 25 years old
25.
When I came to Samiling. I moved to Samiling, and as you do when you're that age, you think, oh well, maybe this will work, maybe not. If not, I'll find something else. I brought my tent. I was hitchhiking up through England.
Oh my gosh.
And then I stayed there for 6 months. I had saved up enough money just to live there for 6 months. It was very, I can't remember how, what you paid to stay overnight, but it was very, very cheap. And this was a time when the 16th Karmapa was traveling in Europe. That was his second visit to Europe. He's the head of this particular lineage. And Akon Rinpoche, who was the founder of Samyaling, he was traveling in Europe, organizing his tours, and he was very little in Samyaling. And it was very quiet at that time. But so I stayed there, and occasionally Akon Rinpoche would pop up and check everything, and everybody was okay. And then in December 1977, His Holiness Karmapa, the 16th Karmapa, came with his whole retinue, and Akon Rinpoche. They then came and stayed in Samyaling and gave teachings and empowerment and refuge. And that was where I took refuge and officially became a Buddhist.
A Buddhist.
That's how you become a Buddhist. You take refuge in it. There's a sort of ceremony. So,
I see.
So by then I'd had 6 months to assimilate and to, you know, read lots of books. And sort of be clear in my own mind that, yeah, definitely this was very clear to me. That's what I wanted, following the Buddhist path.
What was it about Buddhism that spoke to you, whereas the other exploration you'd done hadn't spoken to you?
It was something that just talked to me directly in a way that it made sense to me. A lot of it is sort of common sense, actually. And also, there are tools to work with in Buddhism. And I'm sure there are in other faiths as well, in other religions there are also, but for example in Christianity, now I grew up in Denmark, a Christian, supposedly Christian country,
mm-hmm.
but certainly the contemplative side or the meditative side doesn't really exist anymore, and I think in a lot of Christianity that has faded, sadly.
Mm.
So whereas in Buddhism it's about, you say, you have to have two wings for a bird to fly.
Mm-hmm.
And one, say, is the philosophy, like the view. You have to understand the ideas and where it's coming from and where it's going and where it's going to take you and what are the benefits and what are the trip-ups and what is the goals. And the other wing is the practice. Meaning you assimilate all of that through meditation, through the contemplative side of it. Mm. Without those two together, it's like you were a bird with one wing.
Right.
If we learn a lot of teachings and they stay intellectual, meaning we don't practice them, we don't make them part of our own life, then it's incomplete. We don't get the benefit. You could say it's a little bit like we have food, we have wonderful, nourishing food, and maybe we know everything there is to know about nutrition. Maybe we are the greatest, you know, we know how to cook the most amazing dishes. But if we don't eat it, we don't chew it, we don't taste it, chew it, swallow it, digest it, we don't get the benefit. That kind of like that, you could say, as an example of how it's the same with our mind, and the danger with many spiritual traditions is that when they become so huge, so vast, that you know, they drop a limb here and there. And in terms of like Christianity, I would say in the West, it has lost a lot of that aspect of the chewing and the digesting side. The meditation, the contemplation, the way that you go into retreat and you assimilate everything that you've learned, and it becomes part of your mind, it becomes part of your being. That's what spirituality and religion is meant to do. It's meant to transform us, it's meant to transform our mind, it's meant to make us better people, so we we're less angry, we're less judgmental, we become more patient. Not that necessarily I'm a very patient person, or I haven't learned everything there is to learn. I have a lot more training to do. I'm just saying that is what really, I think, drew me to Buddhism, is that very direct application.
Mm.
And I think many Westerners, that's what they're drawn to at first in Buddhism. They're drawn to meditation. They come to Buddhism through meditation.
Mm-hmm.
First it's meditation, and then it's Buddhism. Now we see mindfulness everywhere, but mindfulness comes from Buddhism.
It does, yes.
It's just a little aspect of it.
It's a small aspect. It's the start of the journey, isn't it? You know, the first rung of the ladder, if you like, is
yes, whatever journey people want to take, it's not necessarily that it means that it takes you to Buddhism. But in terms of like comparing Buddhism to other spiritual paths, I think that is what attracts a lot of people. There is that very direct connection. There is a bridge between the philosophy and your own daily life. And if that bridge has collapsed, then there's a problem. If the philosophy, the holy books, you know, all the different various world religions are, if that bridge collapses where it relates directly, how can we better our life now? How can we become better human beings? How can we become live our life in a way that is more beneficial for ourselves and for others? Then obviously, then it's not spirituality.
I was interested in what you said about learning. It becomes part of you. It becomes part of your DNA, if you like. It's so in you, your spiritualism, your spirituality and your beliefs. And it helps with impatience and anger and being a better person. Do you think people can achieve that without a religion? Is that possible?
I mean, a religion, is Buddhism a religion, I would say. In any case, that's another question. Can people achieve it without a religion? People can achieve it if they have a view, and if they have, you know, ethics. It depends what we're trying to achieve. How much are we trying to achieve? You know, in terms of what Buddhism talks about, you can't achieve it without understanding the path.
Mm-hmm.
The Buddha taught that path. So without understanding that, you cannot achieve what the Buddha showed you. You have to understand where it leads you. And unless you become a Buddha yourself, then, you know, it's like trying to invent electricity from all over again. You know, why would you want to do that if it's already laid out there? You know, when you are... If you want to invent electricity, you end up getting lots of, you know, you make mistakes, you get lots of shocks,
yeah.
You get hurt
yes.
in the process, so you might as well take the path that's there already. But I mean, you can achieve a lot without religion, sure, if you have ethics, living according to moral ethics. Ethical living is so important, really. You know, if you talk, like in terms of Buddhism, it's called the Noble Eightfold Path. But ethics, pure and simple, is about, can we live a life without harming? And on top of that, can we live a life benefiting others?
Mm-hmm.
You know, can we at least reduce the harm we're doing?
Mm.
That's what ethics is about. That's what Buddhism is also about.
And values, isn't it? It's the values that
values.
We have, that we hold within ourselves.
Yeah.
And how we express those values externally with our behaviours, with our decisions.
Yes. Yes.
With our treatment of ourselves, as
yes.
well as our treatment of others.
Yes.
Most people, if they are harmful to others, probably start off by being harmful to themselves first, and then it gets expressed outwards. So is Buddhism also about self-acceptance, or is it about self-growth? Or
about
is it
both.
Both.
Both. You have to accept yourself to grow. You have to know where you're at. You have to come to some understanding of where you're at and how you work and how your mind functions and what are your habitual patterns and your reactions and all of that. And then to see what they are, accept that this is where I'm at, I have this little tick there, You know, I tend to get so irritable, I tend to get so angry, and actually I'm a thorn in the side of a lot of people out there. And once we see that, then maybe we can start to reduce that slowly, slowly, yeah. slowly. But if we don't see it in the first place and sort of accept that it's there, then it's hard to change.
Mm, mm. If you look back at who you were in 1977, before you picked up that book, and before it spoke to you, what are the major differences that you've seen within yourself since that time?
I was a very, very shy person when I first came to South America. I'm still a shy person in many ways, but at the same time I travel, I teach, I do all these things I would have never managed to. But I think that comes out of a lack of confidence, not having enough confidence. So I have gotten to know myself. I've gotten to know myself with the good and the bad through all these years in retreat. And that means that maybe if you have lack of confidence, maybe you're only aware of your weaknesses. You become more aware of how you can develop your strengths. So I think I have much more understanding of how my mind works. I have much more, through that, I think, understanding of, in general, how the mind works of others. Mm. Mm. And I have more understanding of the Dharma. And with that comes a lot of other sort of strengths. So apart from that, I've grown a lot older. I was only 25 when I came to Seven Links, so whether that it was all due to Buddhism or not, I don't know. It's just simple growth, that as we grow older as well, we change. Mm. And maybe in other ways I have grown, maybe also, you know, it's not like when we grow, it's not always that we grow in a positive direction. I may also have developed some negative traits along the path. You know, you get hardened, you get... that can also happen as a spiritual practitioner, you know, that you become too set in your ways, or too comfortable in your ways, or too familiar with certain things. So there are all sorts of pitfalls, you could say, along the path as well. So I think Buddhism is about trying to stay alert and awake with whatever is happening, and if you do that, then you know, it's like you see what's in front of you. You don't fall into the hole that's in front of you so easily.
Yes, you see it before you're at the bottom, you know, looking up. Actually have the strategy to walk around it. Or is there, there's a wonderful thing I read a few years ago about falling down a hole, and it's not my fault I'm down here.
Yes, first you blame
us. And then eventually I saw the hole that time and I walked around it. And the next day I went down another street where there was no hole there.
Yes.
And it is that expanding awareness, isn't it?
Yeah.
That we have choices as well.
And taking responsibility. I think I've seen that one as well. And I think first you blame others.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start to see, actually it was my own fault.
Yep. Yeah.
You start to take responsibility.
But that's a difficult thing for a lot of people to do, isn't it?
Yeah.
My perception of the world is a lot of people live in a blame
culture.
Mm-hmm. And it's easier to pass the buck than it is to own.
Yeah.
It takes an element of courage, do you think, to take ownership of our lives?
Courage and recognition that if we don't, we suffer anyway. So sometimes it's about seeing that, well, the situation might not be fair, but I suffer less if I have a more sort of relaxed attitude and forgiving attitude. So I'm actually helping myself by doing that.
Mm.
Maybe that also helps.
Mm. Do you ever stop learning?
I think you mean in general, do we ever stop learning? I think it's up to the individual whether they learn from a situation or not. Ideally, I think we don't. Ideally, we should continue to learn.
To expand our consciousness, expand our awareness.
Expand our understanding. There's our understanding, our empathy, our wisdom. You know, in terms of Buddhism, it's a very long path.
Has there ever been a moment since 1977 where you've questioned your decision?
Never. Never. Not even once.
Gosh.
Yeah. No, that has always been, I feel so fortunate. I feel so happy. Being a nun, I think, is the best decision I've ever done. Being a Buddhist has never been any question. Doesn't mean it's been easy.
Mm.
That doesn't mean it's been easy. No, but of course, if you feel that this is completely the right path for you, in terms of Buddhism, it's been very, very clear to me.
Mm. How wonderful.
Yes. Yes, but it's available to anyone. Well, not like,
absolutely, you know, yes.
I'm not monopolizing it.
It is open to anybody who's willing to explore. Yes, it's not a club where you have to be invited to join, is it?
Absolutely.
Anybody can join.
Anyone can join, yeah, if you want to. But it's a hard work. It's, anyway, yes, carry on what you want.
That's interesting, isn't it? It's hard work. Is everything that we want in life that is of value and of worth, is it an automatic assumption or knowing that there is going to be an element of hard work involved? Or do you think there's ever anything that we can achieve anything where it's effortless and seamless?
Yeah, you can sometimes achieve things that are effortless and seamless, but I think that generally, there would have been some effort before that. Before you come to the effortless
well,
stage,
yeah.
There would have been a lot of effort put in.
Yeah.
If you can achieve the effortless stage, but I think it's a pretty accurate description. This idea that we need to we reap what we sow. You know, if you want to be a farmer, you want to have a crop, you have to really plow your fields, weed your fields, get rid of the stones, plant your seeds, watch them grow, look after them, protect them.
Mm.
And then eventually there is a harvest.
Mm.
Generally, I think it's like that. If we just sit around doing nothing, I think it's like that in all areas of life.
Mm-hmm.
I say that to people about meditation, that sometimes people think that a 4-week or an 8-week introduction to meditation, that's it, now they know how to meditate. Now they should already have the results. But if you think of it, if people are so familiar in ordinary worldly life, that this fact that to really master something, you have to put in years and years of effort.
Mm.
You want to become a musician, play piano.
Yeah.
You want to become an artist. You want to become a doctor. You want to become a therapist. Or you want any skill. You want to be a bricklayer. All of it needs training, study, application, until you master it. Mm. And it's the same with our mind. So I think really that makes a lot of sense.
It does. I was reading an interesting article recently about musicians. What sets the world musicians apart, the ones that become the soloists rather than part of the orchestra? And you know, is it a gift that they were born with, this level of expertise? And somebody did a survey of world-renowned and world-class musicians, and they said, no, actually, nobody's born with it. It's down to the amount of hours they practiced.
I think so, yeah.
So you think, oh, my gosh, you know, that person must have been born with a God-given gift.
Yeah.
Actually, no, they just put in more hours of practice
than somebody. They put in more hours, and maybe their parents started nurturing certain skills from very young.
Yes, and maybe they were given that belief about themselves as they were growing up, which helps. So it's everything combined, isn't it, that creates
I think
the
like looking at the Olympics as well, if you think those who became gold medals and all
absolutely.
That, they must have trained incredibly hard.
And when you think about the Paralympics that started yesterday, if you're talking about dedication with the overcoming obstacles, that's an amazing lesson we can take from Paralympians,
definitely.
Isn't it? Of that focus and strength, core strength. If you were to sum up the key messages of Buddhism that are relevant to people walking along the streets that have never been inside any religious institution, and don't even know that they're searching for something, what would it be? What would they be?
Well, I mean, the key message is of Buddhism. Generally we say to sum up Buddhism in a nutshell, there's a little verse from the Dhammapada, the teachings of the Buddha, that says to give up negative acts, to practice positive acts, to tame your mind. That is the teachings of the Buddha, but of course that's a bit sort of abstract to many people. What does that really mean? And the key thing in those lines is to tame your mind, because the reason we can't always do the right thing, even if we would have liked to and we wanted to, and we think, oh, again, I messed up and I, you know, made the same mistakes. I wish I hadn't. Well, we weren't able to, even though we knew what was right in the situation. The reason we didn't, you know, give up the negative or practice the good things is because our mind was not tamed, because we didn't have the mastery of our own mind. So the key line is really to tame your own mind. If we can tame our own mind, like, we benefit so enormously, because that is our enemy number one. There is no outer enemy. If we have mastered our inner enemy, we have no outer enemies. And that means, like, if we learn to let go of the past, if we learn, like, dealing with thoughts, so we can actually master our mind to a point where we don't get so stuck on what happened, and resentments from the past, our childhood from the past, past relationships, broken hearts, what was wrong, how we were wronged. So many people suffer, like, carry a huge load on their back that they don't, it's like needless to carry. That's a very, very common.
Yeah.
And by taming our mind, that means that that's what we do through meditation. The definition of meditation is, don't hold on to the past, don't invite the future, and don't sort of solidify or ponder so much over the present. Instead, live the present, be awake in the present.
Yeah.
So say, don't hold on to the past, don't invite the future, don't solidify the present. Just like the Buddha was called the awakened one. That means that's what he had done. And if we can do that, because this is how people get stressed. This is stress in a nutshell.
Yeah.
And if we, your question was, people in the modern age, like now, people now in the 21st century, how it makes sense to them. One of the big problems is stress. One of the big problems is depression.
Yeah.
Stress and depression. Even though in the West we have everything. So we have all the freedom still. We have so much material wealth, more than we need. But there's a lot of pressure on people's lives. And by taming this idea, taming your mind, learning to deal with thoughts, learning not to worry about the future, learning to let go of the past, then it's like such a, you know, you could say, like, such a freedom that you gain from that. And that means that you can live properly, presently, in the moment. You can have quality time right here and now, because where else are we going to have it if we don't have it now? People plan so much for the future. People are so involved with the past. Thinking. Overthinking is a problem. Overthinking. We tend to feel that the more we think, the cleverer we are. The more we can think about this and ruminate about that, the more intelligent we are. Actually, the way Buddhism looks at that aspect of mind that overthinks is an aspect of ignorance. Which is quite strange, isn't it?
Well, it makes sense, actually, but it's ever so easy to fall into the trap of overthinking and analysing.
It's very, very easy, because the reason it's seen as an aspect of ignorance is because it clouds the mind.
Yeah.
And what the opposite of ignorance is, it's clarity. Clarity. So when all of that fuzz and busyness and concern sort of dissolves like a mist, then the clarity is there. Then there is room and spaciousness.
It's hard. I mean, when you say that, I'm sitting here thinking, yeah, of course, I know that. I mean, it's so logical. You know, the past is gone. What is the point?
Yeah.
You know, learn from it and learn not to do the same thing again or to do it slightly differently.
Yeah.
The bit I guess I struggle with most, is, which I found really interesting, is not inviting the future. Because we're so, in the West, very goal-oriented.
Yeah.
And it's projected onto us in business, particularly, particularly if you run your own business. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to do a business plan for the bank, and you have to think what you want to achieve by this time next year, and what actions are you going to take to get you there. So we are conditioned into constantly looking forward. So letting go of the past, yeah, I absolutely get that.
Yeah.
But not inviting the future,
mm-hmm.
I can feel my body going into panic when you said that.
Yes, but actually it doesn't mean that when you say like that, this is the definition of meditation. So it doesn't mean that we cannot plan the future.
Okay.
It means that when you are training your mind, taming your mind, that is what you are dealing with. And it means at the same time as we let go of the past, we can still learn from the past. We can still look at past mistakes, and we can still be inspired by past actions. So we don't just become, you know, like swipe it off the board, Tibex it off the board, doesn't exist anymore, nothing. It's not that idea. We can engage with the past, and we can also engage with the future, and we can also plan the future, but we don't become prisoners of the thoughts of past and the future. And in meditation, when you're actually formally sitting in meditation, that's one of the first things you do, is you learn to let go of thoughts and try to be in the present, say with the breath, and then you realize that it's one of these things, three things that your mind is so busy with. Either it's stuck in the past, engaging with the future, or it's just churning over the present moment. I can't sit, or I can't do this, or I can, or whatever. Or what's that person next to me doing? So sort of analyzing, judging the present, but not really being there.
Yeah.
And that's why we need training. That's this idea of having the two wings of the bird. Like you say, it's straightforward. Of course it's like that. Of course we know the ideas. The ideas make sense. And I think that's what attracted me to it. It was so straightforward, sensible. But if we don't apply it and train and assimilate it, we don't benefit. Well, to some extent we do benefit just from the view and the understanding,
sure.
but we would not be able to really let go and to really see this sort of transparency of the thoughts, let go of resentments, etc., without training the mind. So it's the other wing. The other wing.
So many people walk around trying to fly through life with one wing, don't they?
Yeah, that's a good.
Which is exhausting. Completely exhausting. If only we knew all we have to do is get this wing as strong, and we'd be fine. Gosh, yeah. I suppose it's getting to the point where this becomes part of your subconscious. So it happens automatically, because most people kind of go through life on a conscious competence level where we're continuing to learn a new way of thinking, a new way of behaving, a new way of being. And it's when it's done consciously, it's when it's exhausting. But again, it's with that repetition, and that practice and that application, it will suddenly switch into our subconscious. You know, a bit like driving. When we're learning to drive, it's exhausting. When we've done it enough times, it's actually our subconscious mind driving the car, because consciously we're thinking about other things.
I mean, that's the Western way of describing subconscious. You wouldn't talk like that in Buddhism. You would say that because that's actually who we are.
Right.
We become who we actually are. Because it's like you become awake. You wake up. Like if you think of it, we spend 1/3 of our life sleeping, 8 hours a night, more or less. That's 1/3 of our lives in our bed.
Yeah.
Now, how much of our so-called awake time are we actually awake? We're daydreaming. We are like sleepwalking through most of our lives.
Yeah, true.
And so you could say this is more like you wake up, you become who you really are. Up until then, you were sleeping. not saying you directly. Yeah. But this is the analogy of what is happening. So it's not really like you are replacing one thing with another. You're not replacing one thing with another.
Okay.
You are more like just basically when you drop those habits, the clarity is there. But anyway, this is probably not meant to be a meditation class. So,
we're sitting in the wonderful centre in London. What do you do here? What is the purpose of this centre for people?
I see this centre as an entry to this. All this we're talking about now, we are very accessible. We are very local. You know, like near Tower Bridge is pretty, or Bermondsey is pretty central.
Yeah.
Central London. So lots we're easy to get to. Whereas our main monastery in Samyling is quite a long way.
Yes.
All the way up 6 hours to get to Samyling. So we are an entryway for people who want to learn more about meditation and Buddhism. And then I'd say we're like a bridge to then go further, go to Samyling, go to other places where they can get even deeper teachings and go on more sort of extended courses.
Mm.
So we're like a first point, but we are more than that because we are also a support for people who live in London and who are practicing, whether they're Buddhist or not, so both Buddhist and non-Buddhist who practice meditation, and they come here regularly, weekly, join the meditation, and this helps them during their week to sustain their practice, because without a center, it's very difficult to do it on your own.
It is.
It's very difficult to do it at home when you're surrounded by your TVs and your family and all the sort of distractions that are
there. It is very difficult. Yeah, so from personal experience, it is very, very difficult. Group meditation is a lot easier.
It gives a lot of strength.
It does.
So that's why we're here. And I think city centers are very important.
Mm.
Even though sometimes people think, see, the Buddhist center, quiet and meditation, now, how can it exist in central London? Some people say to me, how can you live in London? And actually, if you think of it, we have a beautiful park in the front door, we have a little courtyard in the back, we have two nice shrine rooms. It's actually very quiet here.
It is incredibly quiet. I know. It's a little oasis, isn't it, in the maelstrom of London going on all around you.
Yeah.
If I were to say to you, where do you want to be in the future? Where are you going? That seems to be completely contradictory to what you said about don't invite the future. But then you said we can always plan for the future, but it's about being awake in the present.
Mm.
Do you plan for your future, or do you just allow?
Oh, I do plan, but it's not like a rigid planning. It's not rigid, it's sort of like there's some leeway there. But certainly for a long time I have been, my main goal has been to establish a permanent center in London, like which we now have done. It's not only me, it's all the people who have helped along the way. And that is now here.
Mm.
But that has taken a long journey from where we started in 1998 up until now.
Yeah.
So that was the goal all along, to have a place that is not just for short term. Because this is our third building and we had two previous buildings, so they were only short term. Now we own this building, and that means that it's for generations to come.
Yes.
It's not just for this generation.
Yes.
But I hope this building will still be here next 22nd century.
Yes. Yes.
So that was my goal so far. Then I haven't quite gotten further than that.
Okay. You go to India a lot. I know we've talked before. We've been in India at different times. What is your purpose when you're there?
I go to, I'm going in February to the Kajimurnalam to receive teachings from His Holiness Kamapa, the 17th Kamapa in Bulgaria, Ojen Tinle Doje. And it's like you're plugging into the lineage, inspiration. It's a very, very inspiring time. And Yeah, His Holiness is such an amazing, like a living example for everyone of what can be achieved in the Dharma. And so I think everybody sort of flock around Him and they come there for, it's like His main big event every year.
Mm.
And that's what I usually go for. But others here from the center, they're going to, they're also going to Bagaya actually, but a little bit later for teachings with His Eminence Sita Rinpoche. So these are some of our main lineage holders, and that's the reason I go. Like pilgrimage also.
Yeah, yeah.
Virtuous travel. Not just being a tourist, but being a pilgrim where you make aspiration prayers, you make offerings, you circumambulate, like you do all sorts of like positive things in powerful places. This is supposed to be a very good thing to do for anyone.
Is it challenging to be a Buddhist in the 21st century? Because it is an insane world in so many ways. And if you see the insanity that is going throughout the world, I'm not sure if there's more of it than there used to be. I just think it's more widely reported now, so we're aware of it. I'm not sure the actual percentage of it has grown, but is that really challenging to see that?
I think it's more challenging not to be a Buddhist, sorry. it could also be misunderstood, but what I mean is that being a Buddhist, you have methods to deal with that challenge. So if you don't have any methods to deal with all the challenges that are thrown at you in the 21st century, that is very hard. And those methods can come from any, that support can come from any direction. It doesn't have to be only Buddhism. But so for that reason, I would say it's not hard being a Buddhist. No, it's a wonderful thing being a Buddhist. It's a very meaningful thing to be a Buddhist, so that you have ways of dealing with all of that madness.
Do you feel that you would love to extend the message even further, if you could, to impact on so many people who are in so much pain, you know, psychological pain, emotional pain, when you see what's happening around the world?
Well, the Buddhist approach is not so much about reaching out. It's not really, there is no missionary streak in Buddhists.
Right.
They even, doesn't work together with the teachings. It's more about people coming to you. If people come to the center, if people want it, they will come. If people look out for it, they will find it.
Mm.
But you would not go, you would never find like Buddhists out in the streets with leaflets saying, come to our temple, or come here, come there. Of course, sometimes we do put leaflets out because we do want people to know that we're here. But there is a sense that through word of mouth, through internet and all of this, people will find it.
Yeah.
And that's the best way.
Yeah. It's that attraction, isn't it? People will feel drawn to something, and
if they are drawn, then they're open to it, and then they will benefit. If they are not drawn to it, and you go out and you try and force it on people, it will only put people off.
Indeed, very much so. Thank you so much for your time.
That's fine.
It's been an absolute joy. It's gone incredibly quickly.
Yes, I was.
just being, the moment I stepped through the door, this is my second visit here. There is something about the atmosphere here that you do feel stresses sort of sliding off you.
That's nice.
It's an incredibly restful energy, isn't it? It's an amazing energy in this building.
I think so. It's an old library, actually. So I think it was, I always say it was built as a temple to learning. It was built with that whole purpose of, in the 1890s, I think, the whole idea of public library started in the UK, and the idea of knowledge and learning being available to anyone.
Yeah.
And so they are beautiful temples to learning. And in a sense, that reflects in the building itself. High ceilings, lots of light, And so we continue that, in a sense, that temple to learning. But it's now more like inner learning.
Inner learning, yeah. Wonderful. Thank you so much. It's been a joy.
Pleasure.
Thank you. This has been Katie Day, and you've been listening to Creating Ripples, the program that showcases inspirational women across the world.